to live righteously. It's time for another episode of the Cultural Hall. It's episode number 176, and in the second and third block, we are going to be visiting with Brian and Laura Hales, author of a book about Joseph Smith and polygamy. And trust me when I say that you are going to want to stick around for that. We talk about the hard ones, the hard questions, the big ones, but perhaps... maybe a little lighter affair here in the opening block of the Culture Hall. I'm joined with Tom Durham. Am I saying it right, or is it Durham?
Durham.
We just blended all together.
That works.
A filmmaker, a director, a producer. I looked at all your credits. Nerd, I think, was part of it. Geek.
That's right.
Both self-proclaimed and told by others on the schoolyard as you were growing up. But in particular, this film called 95ers Time Runners. And it's all sorts of sci-fi, so we'll get into that as well. But I want to get to know you a little bit. First of all, tell me how you came to know about the Cultural Hall.
Well, I basically for the 95ers project, we do all kinds of grassroots outreach and marketing. Mm-hmm. And so one of my interns, Jessica Chamneys, mm-hmm. who I think was an intern here once upon a time.
Yeah, for me.
She just sent out a big press release to everybody, and then she was contacted back by you guys. So mm-hmm. something about the press release was interesting, I think, and so we just kind of stumbled into each other. In fact, that's kind of been the process for the whole movie. It's been stumbling around from awesomeness to not so awesome, and then here back to awesomeness. So
to hopeful to does anyone care to everyone cares to I know how that goes.
Yep,
that
exactly.
Feeling of. Sometimes you feel like you're in a vacuum, and other times you feel like you could do no wrong.
Yep, exactly.
So let's get to know you a little bit. You are born and raised in...
So I'm from everywhere. I'm a military kid,
okay.
But I ended up going to school here
okay.
and met my wife here. We got married and just suddenly had bills and kids, and so stayed. We kind of never intended to kind of live here, but we ended up really just loving the people, and it's a beautiful place. The air is clean for the most part.
Yeah.
And so we just stayed and got into the filmmaking community here, and that's it. So
how did you meet your wife?
So in film school, I saw this really pretty, slightly...
Where'd you go to film school?
BYU Film School.
Okay.
I saw this very pretty, somewhat intimidating lady, actress in the acting program. And I was too chicken to talk to her, but it so happened that my filmmaking buddy wanted me to be in one of his movies.
Uh-huh.
So I told him if he cast her as my girlfriend, I would be in his movie. And so next thing you know, a couple days later, I had my arm around her and everything like that. And and that was on set, though. So it took several months for that to happen in real life.
She's like, you recognize this is a movie, right? Because you keep trying to do this when the cameras aren't on.
She was dodging me for a while, but finally I scripted out a series of dates that came together in finally us getting married. So
now, obviously you're joking, but there sort of was, there had to have been a plan, right? Where you wrote it out, not necessarily physically wrote it out, but you're like, all right, here we go. I want to marry her. I want to get this.
That's almost exactly what happened.
Really?
And she will pick on me about how carefully constructed my strategy was.
So what was the strategy? Now I'm fascinated.
Well, basically I had to break down her defenses.
Sure.
By scheduling very, you know, certain cute things to get the interest going.
Sure.
And then I sneakily found out what all of her favorite things were, and I put together these epic date productions. In fact, some of them are actually filmed.
Shut up, really?
Yeah, where my I had my, you know, my opening act and my exciting middle, and then my romantic denouements, and finally she said, well, he may not be tall and rich, but no, I'm kidding. That's not what she was looking for. But I definitely wasn't the ideal guy that she was dating.
Uh-huh.
But she became somewhat intrigued by my creativity.
Cool.
And so then, in fact, she is the star of this 95ers
movie. I was
going to
say, I noticed that. I went, wait, Durham? So, Durham, hold on.
That's right. In fact, you'll see Durham all over the credits because it turned out to be a ludicrously, ridiculously ambitious independent film project.
Sure.
And actually my wife is, she's totally amazingly awesome and
way better than you deserve.
Honestly, people see us together and they wonder.
Yeah.
And
they always look and they go, money? Does he have money? Because he doesn't look like he's got money. But,
And so, in fact, she was one of the huge creative and indie, you know, resilient backbones. In fact, in the movie, she plays a pregnant FBI agent. Mm-hmm. And she is actually pregnant in the movie twice.
Oh, wow.
Because the movie took us so long to make, we kept going broke, that that she was pregnant to about the same number of months for our, you know, second and third rounds of shooting.
Hmm.
And so, you know, she does some stunts in there, actually, and she does, and she's pregnant the whole time. She is the real deal as far as acting and just giving it her all to make these creative projects come to life.
Were you ever worried in your scripting of the whole romance and life that she would have written something like, and then they never saw each other ever again? Hey, look at this cool script I've written. What do you think of? Oh, geez.
Actually, we do have some romantic clashes. In fact, the which I wrote in the script. She's married in the story, and they have, you know, their romance. You know, and there's a kissing scene. And
You wrote it.
I wrote it, you know, and she's totally professional, and the co-star is great. But it's funny because the first time we shot it, we were in such a rush because, again, the indie mania, it's totally out of focus.
Oh.
So we had to reshoot the kissing scene.
Yeah. Of course you did.
And it was near our house that we did the reshoot, and people are looking up, what is going on over there?
Yeah. Does he know? Yeah, he knows. He's filming it. These guys are weird. I'm not sure what they're... So finally, he got her to marry, and then the kids ensued and all that.
Yeah. And so it's basically been the creative whirlwind. I mean, basically both of us are she's an actress. I'm a writer, director, and we're also very committed to our families.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the entertainment industry and family life aren't really that compatible.
Sure.
And so that's been our mutual fight is that we want to make these movies. We have this one, and we're starting fundraising on another one actually right now, and the huge battle is how do we do this and maintain the integrity of our families so that our kids don't feel like our careers were more important than they were.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just been an amazing trooper that way. And you know, she's basically raising kids and having kids in the middle of a crazy filmmaking project, you know, and you know, our vacations, all of our money. She's also a very talented voice. You've probably seen her on TV around here and heard her on the radio, and you know, her all of her voiceover work and her commercial money, it's write a check to our little film company, you know, and so that's kind of a mutual struggle. In fact, that's something that's really brought us together is we want to be able to make, you know, very cool, you know, engaging, inspiring media, and try to make a living at it and raise the family. And that's been the kind of the maelstrom that we're fighting with. But so far we're still married, we're still together, you know, and things, you know, now that we've been through this first film project, now we know what we're doing.
Right.
And
they
so,
say the first one is the one where you learn so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish that people could see what you just did, which was look down and go, yeah. Yes, you do. Yes, you learn on the first one. Yep. Is it been a difficult navigation of faith with family and everything like that?
Partly. The stories are deep down, you know, the foundations of all the stories that we work on have a certain
I mean specifically for you guys with your...
Well, yes.
Yeah. Oh, so that's what you're looking
at. Yeah. And so the movies themselves actually kind of keep us grounded because the purpose of the film has that faith connection to it.
Hmm.
And so just finishing the film kind of keeps us a little more faithful. But yes, it's been a huge spiritual struggle, to be honest with you, because the amount of pressure that you're under, you know, no sleep, going bankrupt multiple times for this 95er science fiction film, it took 7 years to make.
Mm-hmm.
And so that process never stopped. And so sometimes you're in situations where you are absolutely relying on, you know, help from above. Mm-hmm. and you're seeing those miracles. And other times you're like, I am totally alone. Why is this so hard? I'm trying to do something that's good. So why shouldn't this be easy?
Come on, God, let's open the door. Let's open some
honestly,
gates to heaven right now.
And there's lots of bruised knees and blood and tears and everything. And it's been a very growth centered process, and I think thanks to my wife, actually, I kind of was able to navigate some of those more challenging moments, because she's really she's ever on one of these days, she's really very strong that way.
Oh, I'd love to.
But yeah, it was some of the darkest times in my life were during this movie process.
And you absolutely made it through with what, her help?
With everything. On, yeah. It was each crisis had its own custom solution, mm-hmm, in the end. One of the really cool things about it, we self-financed most of the, after trying to raise tons of money and utterly failing at that.
Sure.
We mortgaged the house, broke out the credit cards, and did that crazy thing.
Yes.
And so I don't recommend any aspiring filmmaker, don't do that.
Yeah, that's stressful.
In fact, we're still paying.
Yeah.
In fact, just today I was
In fact, if anyone wanted to buy a DVD, they could certainly purchase. Oops, sorry, we got a thing going.
People are already calling in.
Right.
There's a great scene in the movie where she rips the phone out of the wall. So at one of our darkest times, and we were totally, completely out of money, and we still had another set of visual effect shots to do. Mm-hmm. Again, it was a ludicrously ambitious film. And we were broke, no money, credit cards filled up, everything. We heard about Kickstarter.
Sure.
And so we did this Kickstarter campaign, and it was very successful. And that was awesome, getting that money. But what was awesomer is that we realized how many – and these people across planet Earth, mm-hmm, sending us money, sometimes hundreds of dollars from complete strangers.
Awesome.
And you know, I'm at my day job, you know, and my phone is going bling, 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 you got another donation. And it was good money, but the money really wasn't the issue. It was just that I realized how many awesome people there are, mm-hmm, in the world, you know, and like you were saying, when you feel so alone, we realized that people were not only responding to the story, because it's a really cool sci-fi time travel story, but they were responding to my story, my story with my wife, our family, and trying to make this happen. And that outreach and these cool people just reaching out to us for no reason other than that they're cool,
yeah,
was so inspiring that we knew that no matter what, we had to finish the film. Like, yeah, no matter what, we're going to finish this. There are people who are going to love this movie. And there are people out there who want to support people who are trying to do hard, good things,
mm-hmm,
and because of that, we just kept going. I mean, it got hard again after that and
sure,
everything, but we knew we weren't going to stop. We knew that it was going to come to fruition somehow.
Thematically, you were talking about that there certainly is some, not necessarily faith-based, but similar, like people will say with Battlestar Galactica or some of those things where you can see parallels, mm-hmm, to gospel principles.
Sure.
Is that something that we can see within this?
Oh, absolutely. And you probably don't have to look too hard. I mean, there's no overt...
This one is called God. Yeah. There's the sun. Yeah, no, I'm just teasing.
No, and it's... people really, in fact, we get some of the feedback we get. We are worldwide now, so we got into distribution, everything, so you can get it, you know, go to Amazon, you can just
awesome,
get it and buy it, whatever you want. It was at Walmart, you know. It kept selling out in the British Walmart. They live in England. It's always on TV there.
Cool.
I don't know why. We have one great British actor in there, but you can definitely see those. In fact, people comment on, wow, you know, on some of these themes, and they also comment on the lack of blood and guts and, you know, and uh-huh, nudity and all that kind of stuff. They appreciate that. But I'm an uber nerd.
Mm-hmm.
And so into my stories, you know, I go deep into quantum physics and all that kind of stuff. But I personally approach those things from a little bit of a spiritual point of view.
Cool.
And so as you go into the deep weirdo sci-fi, deep within the 95ers universe for this film, even for the stuff that we're doing now, it's just a lot lighter. You'll see that stuff there. You'll see really, really well thought out science,
mm-hmm,
but also these, you know, these spiritual connections. And this particular movie is the focus is very much on personal, the value of our personal agency.
Cool.
And in fact, the story mixed within a very, you know, crazy time travel action thriller kind of thing is loosely based on A Christmas Carol.
Okay.
And so our main character is the Scrooge-ish type character, and she's visited by what she thinks are ghosts, but she realizes that they're actually time travelers.
Huh.
And she's mixing with this big time traveling conspiracy and people trying to, you know, eliminate her and her baby from the timeline and blah, 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 blah. Jeez. And so she ends up having to learn what to value in her life.
Cool. And that sounds awesome.
Yeah, no, it's a story that my brother and I cooked up like 15, 20 years ago. And then over
Was it one of those things where it's like, you know what, it'd be a cool movie.
Exactly.
A movie like this, and you're like, yeah, that would be cool. And then you're like, hey, is Thanksgiving dinner done yet? And then you just kind of move on.
Well, we were a little more crazy than that. We were like, hey, how we're going to make this? I don't know if you remember the DV video revolution, where all these new digital video cameras were coming out, and they were great. We're like, we'll make this on DV. It'll be this big, awesome. It'll be as great as Blair Witch as far as the money making, all this kind of thing. And then I realized, you know, I have no idea how to make a film.
Yeah.
And so, so then I went to film school and learned how to do. I worked professionally for a while, and I've done, you know, some different things. And then I said, okay, now I'm ready to make this movie. I didn't know anything about the movie Biz, which was the extreme crazy heartache out there, but I knew how to make a movie, and so, or at least I thought I did enough, and so so we went crazy with this thing, but yeah, it we're, for me, it's all about story.
Yeah,
you know, unfortunately in the distribution and in the buyers and all the people who actually fund films and all that kind of stuff, they're not very imaginative, and they're not worried about story, honestly. They're worried about a few check boxes that will create sales. And,
sure.
And I totally get that.
Because it's a business at the end of the day for them. It's not art. It's not creation. But
what they don't realize, many of them, I should say, don't realize, is that you can still have a really profitable film that has an awesome story.
Right.
And people will talk about it and recommend it and be like, I saw that film and it had something special.
Right. And, like Furious 7, right? You know what
there
I'm talking
you go.
About?
Exactly.
What, 1 billion and I'm just teasing.
Yeah, well, there's something. It's something for everybody. It's great, you know. But
so that's not the type of film you're talking about.
No. No.
But those boxes were checked on that film.
No, exactly.
Sure.
You know.
But that does give you an example of not what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Where the story isn't really there, but people, you know, they go and do
it. You know, and it's amazing because the market is out there. People really do want the kind of movie that I'm making. It's funny because you'll read some of the reviews on Amazon, and it'll be like 5 stars or 0.
Yeah.
Like, they hate it because they want the boxes. I mean, that's what they want.
Right.
But the 5 stars are like, oh my gosh, this and this and this story, and they did this, and they actually thought about this, and blah, 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 and I want to see more, and it was a little bit low budget, but I don't care. I wish Hollywood would do this. And it's, I mean, you'll see this over and over again. Some of these reviews are like, almost bring tears to my eyes because they're so touching, and that's what I wanted. I knew those people were there. We just had to find them. You know, and so in my next film, hopefully I will be able to check a few more of the boxes,
sure,
but still give them that experience. And so, it's
give me a tease on the next film. When will it be coming out? Is there a Kickstarter or something about that?
Okay. So,
so
this one, we're looking for just traditional funding. It'll be under $1 million, you know, so still an indie budget, but you know, a little higher end production value. Mm-hmm. And we are just fundraising right now, actually. So you can go to pixieperfectmovie.com,
okay,
and you'll be led to it. Anyway, the movie is called Pixie Perfect.
P-I-X-I-E?
P-I-X-I-E.
Okay.
Pixie Perfect, and it is the story of a part-time tooth fairy living in suburbia who is struggling with feelings of inadequacy and depression as she compares herself to the perfect pixies around her.
Huh.
And she does all the wrong things to prove how pixie perfect she is and live up to what she thinks is the perfect pixie life.
So it's filmed in Utah County. Boom.
There you go.
Just season.
In my neighborhood, yeah. On my street.
Yeah.
You know, and so we have the screenplay written, everything like that. It's full of magic. It's full of fun. It's
awesome.
It's a comedy. And your wife
will be playing which role?
My wife is our part-time tooth fairy. We're also going to get stars. We'll have also star faces, you know, people everybody's recognized. And as you kind of indicated, you know, everybody in basically the Christian community, we have these amazing women who, unfortunately, there's this weird epidemic that for some reason, and we discuss these in the movie, some reason they don't feel as awesome as they are.
Yeah.
And that's something that is dealt with, you know, and for, you know, the LDS audience, that's rampant.
Yeah.
You know, in our
we do it to ourselves.
And it's insanity. And so this movie takes a really lighthearted look at it. And so far, so the screenplay's finished, you know, and we have all these beta testers within our target market. And they're laughing and crying. And they're like, you have to make this movie.
Yeah.
And so so we feel really encouraged. And it's going to be, I think, a very special, magical movie release. So in theory, if we do get the funding that we need, again, pixieperfectmovie.com, we will have a small theatrical release next year.
Cool.
And then it'll go DVD and TV and all that kind of stuff.
You'll make sure that we get to be able to be there, right?
Absolutely.
Done.
Yeah.
I want to tell people just one more time real quick about this film, though, that they can purchase in it. And I would imagine in some way that will purchases of this film will help to fund the next film or to pay off this film.
Everything helps. Everything helps.
It's called 95ers Time Runners. And what, a couple hours long? I'm looking for a...
Hour and a half. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Hour and
perfect.
Half long. Yeah. Packed with visual effects. All kind. If you like... very well thought out sci-fi stories, this movie is for you.
Perfect. So people can check that out. And it's 95ers, like the numbers, not...
Yeah, 95ERS, like 49ers, only 95ers. Yeah. So do search, you'll find, you can go to the website, you can go to Amazon, whatever. And it's awesome.
Yeah, I'm excited. I got my own copy right here in my hand. I'm excited to watch it. Tom, anything else we should know about you? I always love that question because it's like people take that question and go, yeah, there's a million things. We haven't talked about barely anything about me, but I don't know that I want to get into it.
Yeah, you can see me occasionally at cons. So I give big nerdy lectures at different Comic Cons, Fantasy Con.
The Salt Lake Comic Con, a huge thing here.
Oh, yeah. And so I'll be there, you know, leading crowds in utter nerdiness. And that's always a hoot. And just the last point I would say is that I do this because I love to do it. I love creating these stories, you know. And so I hope as you know, the public out there really does, in the end, control everything, despite what the buyers and distributors might think, as far as books and movies or whatever. The public really does control it, you know. And so so at least today you've met someone who loves what he's doing because he thinks it's valuable. And so I hope some people out there can respond to that. And I would love to see you at the movies.
Let me ask you one more question before you go. What is your favorite part of your faith?
Wow. Jiminy crickets. That's a great one.
I'm just going to pretend like we're almost done, and then I'm going to heap a huge question on you.
The favorite part of my faith... I'd have to say two parts. I got to give you two.
That's fine. You can have two favorites. You have a couple kids. You have four kids. They're all your
favorites.
There you
go. There you go. The favorite part of my faith is that it has saved my family. Mm-hmm. That's number one. I think without my faith, my life would kind of be a disastrous, but especially I think my kids would be greatly suffering right now for a variety of reasons. And number two, I would say that I find... within my faith, lots of unexpected answers and if you really take it seriously, I find that even with very troubling situations and questions and all that kind of stuff, my faith appreciates individual thought and individual understanding of what that faith is. A lot of people maybe don't feel that way. There's a certain weird, I don't know where this came from, honestly, where this cultural thing came from of that, that, you know, in my case, I'm a Mormon, I'm a Christian, that means something super, super, super specific. And it does mean a few things that are fairly recognizable, but it also absolutely the faith, the real deep faith, the real deep doctrine, real deep relationship with God allows for a tremendous amount of individuality and acceptance of individuals who are very, very different.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Me too. That's awesome. So. Thank you for sharing that. We're going to let you go. Again, the name of the film is 95ers Time Runners, or you can go to Pixie, P-I-X-I-E, perfect.com.
Pixie Perfect Movie.
Movie. Sorry, Pixie Perfect Movie. Is there another Pixie Perfect and it's something else? And I've just led thousands of people astray.
There's probably a bunch of other Pixie stuff, and a lot of people talk about Pixie Perfect and modeling and stuff like that. So, yeah, PixiePerfectMovie.com. And, of course, TomDurham.com has all kinds of goodies.
And that's spelled like Durham.
Durham.
Coming up in the second and third block, we're going to visit with the Hales, Laura C. and Brian H. We're talking about Joseph Smith and polygamy here on the Cultural Hall.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
It's time for the second block here of the Cultural Hall, and I'm joined with Brian C. Hales and Laura H. Hales, and we'll talk about how we have to use your middle initial here because that's what it is. It's Mormon stuff, so we always have to use Mormon initialing, right? Except for me, if I ever become an apostle, which won't ever happen, especially since I've said if I ever become an apostle, I'm going to choose to go by first initial, middle name, and then my last name. So instead of Richard T. Stedman, I would be R. Thomas Stedman, the apostle. So,
sounds very dignified.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, very distinguished.
We're going to talk all about polygamy. You guys have a book that is out. I have it in my hand right here. It's called Joseph Smith's Polygamy Toward a Better Understanding. And we'll get into that here in a minute. But you're thinking Hales, and you're thinking, haven't we talked with some Hales here in the Cultural Hall before? And I'm pretty sure that by the time the Cultural Hall finishes and we're done with it, that we're going to talk to the entire Hales family. Because we've already spoken to Jimmy. We spoke to him a couple of years ago. Jimmy, for people that are lifers, which for you guys, let me explain that. People who have listened to every episode of the Cultural Hall, we call them lifers. If they've listened to absolutely every single episode, we call them lifers with Pioneer Stock. And if they just picked up and started listening, we call them converts. But Jimmy was the LDS guy who came out on YouTube and videotaped it with his, you know, his mom and his sister and friends as he came out and let them know that he was gay. So we interviewed him. And then just more recently, I want to say within the last maybe 3 months, certainly in 2015, we visited with Jolie, who was the Disney ambassador, and she talked about her YouTube channel, which is What Do Mormons Believe? And she made reference to you, both of you, actually, in that episode wherein she said, you know, when I get stuck on some doctrinal things, I'll go to my dad or I'll go to my stepmom and ask some questions there. So before we talk all about polygamy, give me an idea of who else in the family I'm going to be interviewing and for what purposes down the road. Who else am I missing? There's got to be other people, right?
I have a couple of other children.
Okay.
A daughter who has given me my only grandson.
Okay.
And she's down in Phoenix. And
what would I be interviewing her for?
I'm not sure other than she has many talents, and she's just a young mom in the church, and okay. She has her own feelings about how the church can serve her and how she can serve in the church.
Okay.
And then I have another son who just got off a mission and is just getting back into school down in Phoenix as well. And
so are you guys from down there then?
No, my kids just don't like the cold northern Utah winters, so I have three in Phoenix and one in Los Angeles. So
are we assuming that it's the weather, or should we ask some more probing questions maybe about you guys?
That they don't want to be around Dad? You know, you could ask them that. I do think that they like the metropolitan feeling of L.A. and Phoenix more than up here in northern Utah. But I actually haven't heard them openly declare that. They usually just talk about how it's cold up here and they love the heat. So,
Well, it is cold in northern Utah and miserable. Right now, we're pretending to be Seattle with all the rain that we've got most recently. So I know Laura, not your first wife. How long have you guys been married for?
18 long months.
18 long months. 18 long months. So let's talk a little bit about you guys, how you guys came to be you guys. Just give people kind of a background of that, of where you come from, Laura, where you come from, Brian, and then we'll get into Joseph Smith's polygamy. Go ahead.
Well, I grew up in the Midwest.
Okay. Where are we talking?
Minnesota and Michigan.
Okay.
My dad worked for the U.S. government doing research.
What kind of stuff?
He studied the effects of acid rain on the environment.
Okay.
So I turned the ripe old age of 17 and went to BYU.
Uh-huh. So your family born and raised LDS?
Yes.
Where is the conversion in your family?
Samuel Smith preached the gospel to my progenitors, so pretty close.
So pretty
to 1830.
That's cool. That's awesome. I like that. And so you did the BYU thing.
I did the BYU thing. I got married.
What'd you study at BYU?
I studied international relations.
Okay, with the hopes of doing what?
Going on to a degree, editing.
Editing?
Editing. You can do almost anything before you get a graduate degree, and it was very interesting for me to study different cultures, so I did.
Cool. And so what did you want to edit?
Other people's writing.
Just fictional, non-fictional?
Oh, I'm much more into non-fiction than fiction.
Like manuals, though? Like, when I think of editing, I think of, like, step number one and having to edit that, and that sounds miserable to me.
Really? Well, no, actually.
Although, no offense to anyone who loves that stuff, because I know that there's going to be people and emails written that'll be like, you don't understand the importance of editing an instructional manual. It's like, I know, I don't get it. I don't get it.
Actually, after a 25-year little detour, I am editing, and mostly what I edit is historical writing.
Mm. Hmm.
So that's actually quite interesting. I learn a lot on the job.
Not necessarily religious, too. You probably do anything historical.
Mostly religious.
Really? And mostly Mormon?
Mostly LDS, yeah.
25-year jaunt from that time to that. So you were married.
I was married. I had 5 children. Then I wasn't married, decided I needed to maybe figure out a way to take care of myself, which a degree in international relations is kind of difficult.
Yeah, it's sort of like a theater degree, which is what I have.
Exactly. It's fun, but doesn't really teach you any skills. So I have a little Kerr ADHD, so I was paralegal for 6 years.
Okay.
One day, I was staring at the wall of my cubicle and said, if I have to do this the rest of my life, I'm going to die. So I went back to college, got my master's degree in professional writing, started teaching English and editing on the side, and I've never looked back.
Let me ask you this. I won't pry too much, but I will pry a little bit. Being a divorced member of the church, how was that? How did the church serve you? I know sometimes there are people in that group that find themselves sometimes hopeless or alienated or that kind of thing, like they failed with God. It's a huge deal, as I talk to people who have found themselves divorced, either being the one to do the divorcing or a recipient of that sweet letter saying, hey, we're done. How was the church for you during that time?
When you say church, I think of 2 things. I think of the institution, and then I think the body of people.
Sure.
And it was a mixed bag for me. I really felt like I went from LDS royalty to a pariah overnight. Mm. And my children felt the same thing. Suddenly I was thrust from one place in our culture to another.
Right.
And it was a really rough transition.
So how'd you make it through it? Because a lot of people don't.
I had a lot of support from members of the church, from the members of my family. I had a lot of therapy that helped me deal with the change. And I had a lot of spiritual experiences, I have to admit.
Cool. That's awesome. That's okay that I asked that, right?
Yes.
I may ask things like that all throughout
great.
This thing. So then where'd you meet this lug?
Actually, I met him at the best place to meet in your more mature years. I met him online.
Oh, yeah. That's all right. That's cool. You sound like you're a little embarrassed about it.
I'm not really embarrassed about it because I know the other options, but some people who hear it sometimes have a stigma attached to it.
But I think less and less as it goes on and on. I mean, for a while, I think it was like, what? That's weird, or that's odd, or that's so different. But now it's just like, no, I mean, that's... You're meeting people in person, but you're also going online going, I may never run into this person if I don't go online and find these people.
It was really funny because at the time we were living 10 miles apart, but we would never have crossed paths.
Nice. Do you want to give a plug for the website or do we need
it? It was LDS Singles that we met on, I think.
Nice. Very cool. I always tease about the LDS Singles where it's just like, if it were me, I'm married now, but if I ever found myself single again, I'd just be like, listen, I need into the kingdom. Who's in? Who wants to do this with me? Just need passage. Who wants in? We'll figure the rest of this stuff out. But that's obviously just a joke. All right, so you guys met online, and then it was, he whisked you away, and it was perfect, and...
No.
No? That's not what happened.
No, I'll let him talk about this because he's got some splaining to do.
Okay. Well, let's get to know you then a little bit. Give me an idea where your background comes from.
I grew up in Logan. I've been a lifelong member of the church, served a mission.
Where'd
married,
you serve?
Venezuela.
Cool. Yeah. Is there temples in Venezuela now?
They're working on one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So announced but not dedicated?
I'm not even sure. They won't let North Americans into it. It's the most socialistic country in South America right now, and North Americans are not welcome there. So I haven't anticipated going back. But I do know they've announced one. I just don't know where it is.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I wish that would change. But
well, you get a temple in there, and then spiritual things happen, and the country changes.
We hope so.
Yeah, right?
I like that. I like
knock
that.
Knock on table.
A lot. And then married. We have four kids, as we've discussed. Went through a divorce I didn't want in 2000. And about 2006, 2007, I started on this project to write to discover everything we could about Joseph Smith and plural marriage. Mm-hmm. I had questions. They weren't answerable based on anything that was published. And I hired Don Bradley, who is a credible researcher and scholar on his own right, and hired him for a couple of years. And he gathered up every known document. Mm-hmm. And we were able to include those in the three volumes that were published in 2013. But I met Laura actually in about 2011.
Hold
online.
On, though. Before we get into the love story, I want your perspective because, I mean, you made the mention it's a divorce that you didn't want. And then you're being, you know, not the what are we saying? It's the goal as far as a church, you know, be married, sealed in the temple, and then the rest of history is supposed to light its, write itself. How did you deal with that? How did you come through that difficult time without... Because I think it's more common for the men to be the ones that say, you know what, church, I'm out. I think the women, because they feel the responsibility, and this is a generalized statement, so everyone who's going, well, that wasn't the case with, I get it. But, you know, the women, oh, I got to keep going to the church for kids. I want to, you know, make sure that the kids are raised right. But the men are like, I'm out. So how did you stay with it?
You know, there's some irony here because prior to our divorce, several years, my then wife and I were the ward and then the state couple for the singles. Hmm. And we were responsible for reaching out and establishing the program or, you know, at least implementing the program the church then had. And there was a lot of latitude on the program. And what I learned in the few years that we were involved with the singles program as a married couple, administering in that role, was that you only reach about 30% or less of the singles in any one approach. And so I was in long enough to revamp the program, and it had just been revamped when we came in to try to reach more. And my conclusion after we were finally released was that I don't think there is a program. People sometimes are critical of the church, saying it's a married church, there's no place for me as a single. Well, mm-hmm. as somebody who was on the married side trying to minister to singles, I could not, you know, with all the prayer and muster that we could come up with some program that would meet even a majority of the singles. Mm-hmm. I think that's a phantom. I don't think there is such a program. So when people criticize the church for not reaching out to singles, I would just say, well, why don't the singles who feel like they're not not having their needs met, design a program that's going to reach more than 30%. I don't know what that would be, because sure. I've been there. I've tried to do that on a stake level when we were in the stake, and I could not come up with it. And so I remembered those things when I was single, and I didn't hold the church accountable for the fact that I really didn't feel like my needs were always being met. You know, you have a home teacher, and that individual is kind of the one who's supposed to be doing a lot of that. But the church programs are more geared to family and to children and things like that. And it was hard for my kids, not from a church standpoint, but just the whole transition was very difficult.
Yeah. Kids try and figure that out. All right, so now let's get back to it. Now back to the love story.
Well, Laura and I met online in 2011, and it may have been LDS Planet. It was one of the two.
Which, by the way, is such an ironic name, LDS Planet. I just love that.
Yeah.
And my favorite parts, too, just as a side jaunt. So I, through my day job, have done advertising through LDS Planet, not owned by LDS people at all. It's through another service, and they have no idea the irony of LDS Planet being named that.
No, that's interesting. Well, I would highly recommend the online overall. I think, I don't know, Laura can weigh in whether she thinks
that
it worked for us. But but anyway, we met online. We dated a few times, and I think we both felt the pressure to move forward. And at that point, I was still writing my three volumes on polygamy, and mm-hmm. I couldn't see doing both. And so basically we broke up, and Laura went off and dated, and I finally finished the trilogy, the three volumes, which are took a lot of effort. It took about 6 years, but just months after that book was published, I saw Laura, I think it was on Planet the second time, and in the meantime, she'd gotten her master's degree, and I just remember thinking, now, why did we break up, and, you know, what was going on there? And at that point, I just thought, you know, I think this could work, and I dated quite a bit up at that point, and so I was excited for us to get back together, and it worked out.
Yeah, Brian, this is God. You're being a dummy.
Exactly.
Try this again.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, what happened?
I got this.
Book's done. This could go forward, and I want it to, so it did.
And so then it did, and as she put in, 18 long months.
Long, miserable months. Actually, we've had a great time together.
This book, though, not obviously your three-part volume. This book is simple and edible, and I love it. It's called Joseph Smith's Polygamy, Toward a Better Understanding. So let me just be honest where I come in on it. Because of the contact that I have, not only through doing this, the Cultural Hall, but being a fairly, I don't want to say fairly well-known, but when people associate me, they associate me with Mormonism, and there are a lot of people who then feel the need to tell me why I shouldn't be a part of the Mormon Church anymore. And one of the big things that people will always come about is, how about Joseph Smith and all of his wives? What about Fanny Alger, or Alger, depending on how you pronounce it? What about these people? What about, and just go on and on and on. And I'll be honest, though, I find myself to be fascinated by church history. The polygamy part of Joseph Smith is something that I've completely kept myself aside from. So let's talk about it. Can we just dive straight in?
Sure.
All right. So what's the deal? No, I'm just joking. We'll make it a little more specific than that. 38. Am I correct? 38 wives that we know?
35 by 30, my count, 34 okay. by her count. We disagree on one of them.
Oh, so. Really? So... And so already we get why I feel like I haven't dove into it as much as maybe I should. I feel like there's not a lot of definitive stuff about it. You're going to tell me that there is, I hope.
No, we're not going to tell you that.
Okay. You're going to let me make my own conclusion that there is?
No, there's not a lot written about it, and that's why we don't have shelves and shelves of books written on Joseph Smith's polygamy. Mm-hmm. It was kept very quiet and secretive. They were afraid to write things down. You got to realize a lot of this unfolded right after the Missouri massacres mm-hmm. and escaping Missouri. They were very afraid, for good reason, of being persecuted and prosecuted. So... when Joseph Smith's plural wives were sealed to them, they didn't go home and write it down in a journal. unfortunately. And if they did, it didn't survive. So we only really have about four bodies of work to draw from. Hmm. And a lot of it is late recollections, which, you know, have problems.
So let's talk about that. What do you mean? When you say late recollections, like later in his life and people going, oh, yeah, I remember when I was married.
We wish. Yeah. No, we're talking like if someone recorded a conversation they had word for word in 1905 that occurred in 1842, that's a little prone to blended memories. I can't remember what I said word for word in conversations I had this morning.
Right.
So it's kind of hard when someone's pulling that apart word by word and trying to opine deep meaning out of it to say, yeah, this is a really valid source for us to decide really important things about.
Right. So what are you... You mentioned that there are basically just kind of four really great documents or documentation that we have to pull from. What are those?
You know, we're really grateful to the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's now the Community of Christ, because they sent missionaries out in 1860s and 1870s, and these missionaries came to Utah, and they were saying Joseph Smith, our prophet, was not a polygamist. And as a reaction to their claims, many of the Nauvoo polygamists recorded their own recollections. If the RLDS Church had not come out and made those claims, a lot of these affidavits and things that were collected would not have been collected, and we would even know less than we do now. But in 1869, Joseph F. Smith, who was an apostle, he was one of the newer apostles, but he went through and collected 55 affidavits from Nauvoo polygamists, including quite a number from Joseph Smith's own wives, saying, yeah, I was a plural wife to Joseph Smith. And that's one of the biggest collections that we have. And then fast forward to 1887, again, the RLDS missionaries are out and making their claims, and Andrew Jensen compiled a whole new list of documents from the polygamists that had been in Nauvoo, and also took some private notes, and we're grateful to Don Bradley, who was the first to really view these, and there's some very important notes there. The last collection is in 1892. The RLDS Church again were claiming ownership of the temple lot in Independence. Mm-hmm. The Hedrickites, which owned the lot, said, you're not Joseph Smith's church because he practiced polygamy and you don't practice polygamy. So polygamy became a huge issue in this lawsuit, and the Utah Church supported the Hedrickites, even though the Hedrickites were against polygamy, and a lot of depositions were taken to prove that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy, and the RLDS ultimately lost that case because of the testimony of men and women. Three of Joseph's wives were still living in 1892, and they testified that they had sexual relations with him, and it wasn't just some spiritual endeavor. And as I said, the Hedrickites prevailed. So those are the four things: the 1869 affidavits, the Andrew Jensen published version, the Andrew Jensen unpublished papers, and then the Temple Lot depositions.
I want to get to a few questions, but before we take a break for just a second, Hedrickites are based from what?
Well, and I shouldn't use that term. They don't like it. It's the Church of Christ Temple Lot.
Okay.
And they were founded by a man named Granville Hedrick.
Okay.
And that's why we've referred to them that way.
So. I'm fine with it. I wanted to know, like, I know Bickertonites are obviously from, you know.
Yeah, these guys still own the temple lot. If you go to Independence, you'll run into them there. They have their little building, and they'll be happy to talk to you and give you a little discussion about it.
Okay, so I want to take a break for a second, but I want to come back, and I actually want to dive into these things where we talk about and help understand. Hopefully we can at least shed some light on things like, so Joseph Smith married a bunch of people who were already married. And I want to talk about it. And then I think maybe a bigger concern for some, I think maybe an equal concern for some, the age of some of these people and how all of that worked, and probably a lot more that I can't even think of right now. But we'll come back and talk about that in just a second in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Hi, this is Dan, the Laptop Man from PC Laptops in Salt Lake City. A lot of people ask me if a gaming console or a gaming PC is better. Gaming consoles do one thing. They play games and usually come with a one-year warranty. A desktop or laptop computer from PC Laptops plays games and allows you to learn real career skills like Photoshop, video production, and business skills so you can make a living with technology. Technology that makes you money. Amazing. PC Laptops desktop computers start from only $799, hand-built right here in Utah with a lifetime parts and labor warranty. You simply can't find anything like this backed by an amazing lifetime warranty anywhere. It's downright impossible. Please visit any one of our locations right now or call us at 1-877-596-SAVE or check us out at PCLaptops.com. That's PCLaptops.com. Desktop computers covered forever with a lifetime warranty starting at $799. Because at PC Laptops, we love you.
All right, time for the third block of the Cultural Hall, sitting down with Brian C. Hales and Laura H. Hales. We haven't talked about the middle initial. What does C stand for, Brian?
I'm Clint.
Okay.
Like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. And he's just as tough and intimidating. And then Laura, what is the H?
Harris. As in maiden name.
Yeah, as in before I got married.
Exactly.
You guys have a website. Let's talk about that real quick. Give me the URL.
It's josephsmithspolygamy.org.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about some of the nitty-gritty or the questions that are always coming up. And we have on that website an FAQ tab.
Which stands for Frequently Asked Questions
there
for people
you go.
Who don't know.
And all of these questions, there's seven of them that we've identified, including young wives, including polyandry.
So what are the others then? Can you go through all seven right now, do you think, without looking at the website right in front of you?
Well, let's see. There's Fanny Alger is one. The denials is another. We mentioned polyandry and young wives.
Okay.
Emma Smith is a big one.
Okay.
What's the seventh? Anyway, you can go there. There's seven that we identified.
Okay. So it's josephsmithspolygamy.org. So let's get into those four that you remember, or those couple that you remember then. And then we'll talk about the purpose and why we brought you guys here and what you hope to get through all this. Let's talk about Fanny. For people who don't know who she is, introduce her to people, and then let's go right to it.
Fanny was a young woman who was living in the Smith household in Kirtland.
Okay. She say young woman. How old are we talking about?
Well, it depends. We don't know exactly when the union occurred. I believe it was 1835, and she was 19 in 1835.
Okay.
Could have been as late as 1836, plausibly, as well.
Isn't it frustrating to kind of have this stuff where it's like, well, it could be. And that, I mean, I guess is just the nature of historical things, unless it's so properly documented and everything like that. But you just have where it's like, well, it could be 1834, but it also could be 1843, and it could be in a different state. And not that wide. I just think that
Well, I hope your listeners get from this that there are not a lot of absolutes as we're looking back nearly 200 years at what occurred.
Yeah, and opponents of the church would let you know, no, it is an absolute, and how could you possibly feel this way? You need to know that absolutely this is the case, and I know it. And then you come to people like yourselves who have spent years researching it and writing about it, and you go, yeah, maybe. That maybe could be the case. It could also not be the case at all.
Well, and you know, as Don Bradley and I were working on this in about 2009, 2008, it dawned on me that if we continued, we could get every known document and include it in the three volumes, which we did. But as Don Bradley and I were working on it, we didn't know what we were going to find. We were both believers. Well, that's not true. Don Bradley was out of the church at the time and then later came back in. But I didn't know what I was going to find. But I was a believer. And so there was some concern. And I would just say that even though there are things that I don't really understand, and there were some things that Joseph did that I wished he hadn't. There is nothing egregious in his behavior. He's accused of stealing men's wives or of committing adultery. The evidence is not there. The evidence that the people who make those claims, it's ambiguous, and they're drawing their own speculations and then condemning Joseph based on their speculation. There is no smoking gun, even in polygamy. As weird as it is, as strange as some of the unions were, there is nothing there. there that I found that is convincing that Joseph Smith was a hypocrite with respect to sexual morality.
So, Fanny.
I was going to say, so back to Fanny. She was living in the Smith household in the mid-1830s, working as a domestic. There were 10 children in her family, so she...
So what does that mean, like doing all the kind of...
Housekeeping.
Chores? Okay.
Cleaning. And at some point, Emma discovered there was a relationship going on between Joseph and Fanny. Mm-hmm. And she became very upset. And she was so upset that Joseph summoned a couple of his trusted associates to come over and maybe give her a blessing, settle her down. Mm. And what ended up was both Emma and Oliver Cowdery became convinced that Joseph had been having an affair with Fanny Elger, which he denied.
And which Joseph denied.
Yeah, Joseph denied. But Emma ended up asking Fanny to leave the home. And she went to live with the Webb family at that time. Mm-hmm. And then shortly thereafter left with her parents to head west, stopped in Indiana, got married a couple months later, never rejoined the Saints, but also never spoke about this episode with Joseph. Hmm. And her parents always referred to it as a marriage and remained with the Saints their whole lives, traveled out west. Joseph Smith was called before the High Priest's Council and questioned about
this. Like a disciplinary council?
Well, more an informational, oh, okay. We'll say. They investigated it, and he said it was not adultery. We have one account written in Levi Hancock's journal, not actually written by Levi, but overwritten by his son Mosiah, that gives us account of a marriage ceremony that he performed on behalf of Fanny and Joseph. And we have no really accounts from the three major players in this, Fanny, Emma, and Joseph. Hmm. What I've told you is about what all we have.
Fanny was not the first additional marriage, or was she?
It's the first one we know of.
Yeah. So maybe, but again, maybe not. But as far as records would show, that she would be the first one.
Oh, yeah. I think if it were someone else, we may have stumbled across something.
There's nothing to support anything earlier than Fanny.
Okay.
Just speculations on the part of critics.
Hmm. Now, I remember hearing, and maybe you can help me kind of know the truth about this. I remember, and I don't know if it was in reference to Fanny, but that as there was another person in the household, Emma becoming physically violent towards another of the wives. Is that Fanny that story is? Is that story even something that exists?
It wasn't Fanny. I don't think so.
Yeah, I think it's
the
Eliza.
I think you're Eliza. And there's a couple. There's several stories out there, the reliability of which varies according who's telling it.
Hmm. The one that's most prominent is that Emma saw Joseph and Eliza R. Snow, who was pregnant, according to the story, and they embraced, and Emma got mad and threw Eliza down the stairs, and she lost the baby and became sterile.
Right.
And we discussed this in our book together, and I've compiled all of the accounts in the larger three volumes. I think it's apocryphal. I don't think there's any truth to it at all. I think
Mormon
it was,
folklore, even
back
then.
Yeah, but people can read the accounts and make their own decision. But there's lots of reasons to believe it's just not true.
So fairly short-lived as far as Fanny goes. But for people who are being introduced to her and to her story, that's basically it. She came out west. It is interesting to note, though, that she came out west, if I'm understanding you. Her parents stayed with the church. She came out west anyway and just didn't unite again with the Saints?
No, I didn't explain that very well. She headed west. She stopped in Indiana
got
married, and she stayed there.
Okay.
But her family continued to be part of the body of the Saints all the way through Utah.
Hmm. So now let's talk about the wives, but these women were already married, so they're getting married again. How does that work?
Well, the word is called polyandry.
I wish that people could see how the interaction between the two of you goes when I ask a question. It's like, huh, you? Are you going to take this? Why don't you go ahead?
We've both handled these questions because they're very bona fide questions.
Yeah.
They're troubling to hear, at least on the face, that Joseph Smith was involved with these things. And unfortunately, we don't have people giving us all of the details or enough of the details to really discern what was going on. The word polyandry really means a woman having more than one husband. And there's no question that Joseph Smith was sealed to some women who had legal husbands. And so, again, those who are kind of hostile to the church are going to say, see, those women had two husbands. And Fawn Brody, whose biography has become very popular, she even said, yeah, Joseph was sleeping with them and then sending them off to sleep with their husbands. And that's, again, that's historical fiction based upon the evidence. What we find is that 14 of Joseph's sealed wives had legal husbands, and by our accounting, 11 of those were eternity-only sealings. And most members haven't heard of an eternity-only sealing. They don't do them today. They only did a few, and Joseph did most of them, but there were other men in Nauvoo and later in Utah who had the equivalence of an eternity-only sealing, where a woman has a legal husband who may not even be a member of the church, and that's her husband here on earth, but then when she dies, she's sealed for eternity to somebody else, in this case, Joseph Smith. And then 3 of the 14 women had legal husbands but were physically separated from those men and were not cohabiting with them. And in my view, and I think Laura agrees, that sexual polyandry, a wife having two genuine husbands, would have been adultery. And Joseph would not have tolerated it and certainly did not practice it. But still, when you read about these marriages, it's troubling. Why would a woman be sealed to Joseph? And the answer that we have is simply they chose to be. Lucy Walker said that Joseph taught her that a woman would have her choice and that would not be denied her. But we still are left with the question, why would a woman choose Joseph if her husband was an active Latter-day Saint? And that right. apparently occurred several times. And we don't have an answer for that.
I think we can answer the question why a woman with a non-member husband was sealed to Joseph more easily.
Right.
Just because there was such a sense of urgency in their life. Every temple they had been destroyed or not been able to be built. They were experiencing persecution in Nauvoo, and they didn't know how long they would have a temple, or even their life had a certain uncertainty to
sure.
it that we don't have in our lives. I've never been through the kind of experience that they had in Missouri. And so sort of securing their exaltation was really important to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have a way to do that with a non-Mormon husband, and Joseph was a way to achieve that
goal.
Yeah,
that part makes sense to me.
So that's much easier to explain, and I think that is less bothersome to many people if they look at it in that light.
Right. But I think, I mean, like you say, but coming to those 11 where it's like, all right, so he's active or the prophet, which do you want, you know?
Well, actually, 11 were not active.
Okay.
11 were just eternity only.
So talk about that for a minute. A practice that only existed for a little while. Is that something that, as Latter-day Saints, we believe in the complete restoration as it comes again full circle will exist again? Eternity-only sealings? Or is that something that we went, oh, well, we just did that for a short while? Is there doctrine that's behind it? Talk about eternity-only marriages.
The first generation of Latter-day Saints to be introduced to eternal marriage, they had already chosen their husbands just for this life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could think, well, if you're going to want to be married to them for this life, then they should also think they would want to be married to them for the next life. But
yeah, some.
during that generation, though, they were given an option. And there's several accounts. Again, they don't come from always the best sources, basically saying that from an eternal standpoint, nobody was married to anybody. And you got to choose again whether you want it to be sealed for the next life to the person that you were married to for this life. Mm. And so for that generation, we can understand why they may have been given an option. Again, it seems kind of strange to me, but that's what happened. That first generation to be introduced to eternal marriage were allowed, some of them, and we're talking probably less than two dozen total, and probably half of them were Joseph Smith, and then there were others scattered here and there, but they were allowed to make that choice, and then it was no longer needful, because from then on out, men and women would choose each other for time and for eternity and be sealed thusly. So.
That's fascinating.
You have to, I think your question went a little bit further than that, if I'm not mistaken. You have to realize that there's a difference between a legal marriage, according to the United States of America,
right,
and the religious sealing that was going on.
Absolutely.
And if you think about the proxy sealings that we do in the temple today, the people are already dead, so they are essentially being sealed for eternity.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that respect, that practice continues.
I hadn't thought about it like that.
Cool.
So let's go back then as we talk about JosephSmithPolygamy.org.
Yes.
What are the other questions? We hit the Fanny Alger one. We hit that they were married to...
Do we have to remind you? Young wives seems a little bit bothersome to a few people.
And I think that people look at it and they want to say, well, it was a different time and people got married younger, and that's how some can kind of compartmentalize it and go, well, it was... But back then people lived shorter amounts of time and the rights of women, you know, we think of that kind of stuff. But still, it's an older person marrying a younger person. So let's dive in. I'm looking at both of you.
I don't think what you said is a bad argument. It was a different time. So tell me what part about that bothers you.
Again, for me, so bringing it back on me, this is something that... Maybe it's my naivety. Maybe it's fear of, as you mentioned, Brian, earlier, I don't know what I'm going to find out or how things are going to come to me. But I haven't really dwelled too much about it, because when it comes down to the gospel for me, I don't know that it matters. Right? But there are a lot of people that have to say, but this kind of stuff matters. The church history, its actions, the actions of its leaders do matter. And I think at my core, I don't know that it matters as much to me. So I don't know that I have a question or an answer to your question. I don't know. I know that older men marrying younger women bother me now. Like if you were to marry, Brian, if you were to marry someone that is 14, I would have a problem with that because I think that's inappropriate. But I don't know the time. I'm not in that time frame. I don't know the woman. I don't know the man. Studied about Joseph Smith, but I don't know. So I feel like as a person that I am, I can't say, oh, this is terrible, or oh, this was fine, or oh, this shouldn't be a thing, or oh, this should be the biggest thing in the world, because I am this far removed from it. But a lot of people can't just say, oh, well, that was then, this is now, let's worry about now. So I feel like it has to be addressed at least in some way.
I feel of the young wives, only two really would be of an age to maybe raise eyebrows. And one of them, we know nothing about the courtship and marriage. That's Nancy Winchester.
How young and how old was he? How old was Joseph at the time and how young was Nancy?
We don't know when they were married. We just know when they were sealed by proxy in the Nauvoo Temple. We can guess that she was around 14 or 15.
Okay. And he would have been Nauvoo. That would have put him at least 34 or 35.
36. Around there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So still, even in that time, a considerable age difference, right? I mean, being fair and honest about it. So that's one. Who's the other?
It was Helen Mar Kimball. That one, to me, is relatively straightforward and easy to explain, even though a lot of people don't like it. Sometimes history we don't like, but it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Helen's father was very close to the prophet, mm-hmm. and he wanted to tie his family to the prophet. Helen was starting to date a lot, and he was getting ready to go on his mission, and he wanted to see his daughter married to Joseph. Mm-hmm. And so he figured if he came back, she might already be betrothed. So he wanted to take it care of this before he went on his mission.
Sure.
It was just before she turned 15, the summer before, actually, the end of May.
Hmm.
So he went to Joseph and said, "Will you marry me, my daughter, Helen?" He proposed it to Helen. She, at first, was not really hip on the idea, but she respected her dad and she trusted him, and so she agreed.
Mm-hmm.
Helen's mother agreed to the union, and they were sealed. No evidence of conjugality at all at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But if there had been, they were, in the eyes of the church, sealed in a legal marriage,
right,
in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
So Helen went on later to become a great defender of the faith in general and polygamy in particular. She wrote two tracts. I consider them her to be the number one defender of polygamy,
mm-hmm.
in Utah. She also adored her husband, yes, Horace, when she remarried, but her father and her mother till her death. So she didn't resent what happened enough to say, you know, "I wish my parents hadn't made me do this." So I figure where all of those involved were okay with it, I need to kind of step back.
Sure.
You know, there have been some people who've claimed victimhood for Helen. We've got an email just this past week from some woman claiming we were lying, and it went on and on. But people want to – one writer even said the church needs to apologize for Joseph Smith's marriage to a 14-year-old. And if Helen were here, and based on our research, we both agree that Helen would be the first to disagree with these characterizations of her and her alleged victimhood.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is a little difficult for us to understand. And I think the biggest problem is that the critics will portray Joseph as not a pedophile, but as somebody who's looking for young women for sex.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to point out that with respect to the two 14-year-olds and the 16-year-old that Joseph was sealed to, that we don't have evidence of sexuality with any of those. And there's strong evidence, I think, with Helen that that marriage never was consummated.
Mm-hmm.
And we won't go through the details here, but people who want to say that he was looking for young wives for sex are making it up, because the evidence is just not there.
And you've not only documented the evidence, and people can find it in your three volumes, but
yeah, and in this book as well.
In search.
Yeah. It's all there. And they can make their own choices. We present all of the evidence. But again, when people make these claims and these assumptions, they're just doing it upon speculation. It's not evidence-based.
Of all the plural wives, we have the most information on Helen, because she wrote a series of articles in the 1880s Women's Exponent, which anybody can access those online at archives.com, I think it is.
.org,
archives.org, and read for themselves. It's interesting.
Cool.
So if you want to explore any wife, explore Helen and see what you come up with.
Hmm. So a few questions that kind of have come up as we've been talking. Put it in perspective for me. How many wives did Brigham Young have, and how many wives did Joseph Smith have? Do you guys know?
Brigham was sealed to somewhere in the range of 50. He had children by, I think, 16 or 17.
Okay.
At that point, both he and Heber C. Kimball were sealed to a lot of women because they needed a husband to take care of them. I mean, Heber C. Kimball is quoted as saying that he's got something like 30 wives, but he was sealed to a lot more in Nauvoo, and he hasn't seen them since Nauvoo, and he hopes he never does. The reason being, and this wasn't really a negative on them, it's just that if they showed up, being their husband, they would expect him to take care of them, and he already had quite a large family as it was. So, again, when we hear of people getting married, the first thought is, oh, you know, the man wants this big harem or something, and sexuality is an issue there. But these women couldn't take care of themselves very well in that pioneer age, and attaching themselves to the family of a prominent church leader was something they needed for their own survival. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they had to look to their own siblings or their own parents or something to take care of them, but they just couldn't do it on their own without some help.
Another thing that I thought of as we were talking, you said that you, Brian, said 35, that she would say 35 and that you would say 34. So what's that discrepancy?
I'm actually going down to 33 more research.
Okay. As far as the number of wives of
age. Yeah, I just think the evidence is so nebulous. You know, someone shows up at a funeral and cries, and suddenly she's Joseph Smith's wife.
Is really the connection for some of these people?
For one of them.
For one of them, yeah. Yes. You know, and proximity. If Joseph visited the house and stayed for a while, she's Joseph Smith's plural wife. So, I think when it's sketchy like that, to me, it doesn't matter if it was three mm-hmm. or 35.
Right. It's still, it's more than one.
It's more than one.
Yeah. Another question that never dawned on me until now. We know that Joseph Smith had children with Emma. Did Joseph Smith have children with people beyond Emma?
That's the other FAQ. We forgot. That's
the seventh FAQ. So there is evidence for two children, possibly three. One of them is a child to Olive Frost, one of the plural wives, and both she and the child died before the saints left Nauvoo. We don't even know the gender, but we have a couple of attestations supporting that. The other one is quite controversial. It's Sylvia Sessions Lyon, and there are some books that have portrayed her cohabiting with her legal husband, Windsor Lyon. At the same time, she's probably cohabiting with Joseph. But her legal husband was excommunicated in November of 1842. Okay. And there's good evidence that she stopped living with him at that point. She conceived a child, which I believe is Joseph Smith's child, in the following March or April. And that child was Josephine Lyon Fisher. She married a guy named Fisher. They came out and settled in Bountiful. And they've done DNA testing on her, and the first set of tests were equivocal in that they were actually positive, but because of static from intermarrying between the two Lyons prior to Joseph and Sylvia Sessions Lyon, the mother, you couldn't say for sure that this was positive, and so it just has gone on as being a non-positive result. We understand from talking to family members that they're actually doing a much more detailed test, which should be able to tell us for sure whether Josephine Lyon Fisher is Joseph Smith's offspring or not. We're anxiously awaiting it, but to be honest with you, I'm 90% confident that she was Joseph's daughter, and I will not be surprised if the DNA comes back positive.
When is that supposed to be coming out?
Well, the family's taking contributions. If you want to contribute to the DNA study fund.
They're very expensive. In fact, it's using technology that wasn't available even 5 years ago, we're told.
That's fascinating. And then from her line, is there any sort of... Have we studied that line of Josephine down to modern day? Is there any...
There's a lot of people with that DNA, good active church members, and some who've even left the church because of the possibility. And this is not uncommon. In our research, Don Bradley and I encountered several families that were sure that this person or this child was Joseph Smith's child. And at least a couple of times, Don and I would look at just the historical evidence, and Joseph wasn't within 200 miles of this woman for 6 weeks either way of the conception date, but the family hadn't looked at the history enough to even know that. Even even without DNA testing.
But come on, look at his nose. Right. He's got Joseph's nose.
Well, and that was the level of their research, and the willingness of some of the progeny to make these claims and assumptions, it was remarkable to me that they were willing to condemn Joseph or make the assumption that this child or that child was Joseph's. DNA testing has ruled out six of the most likely children that Fawn Brody and others have said, oh, yeah, this is Joseph's child. Well, DNA testing has proven that Joseph was not the father. None of it has been positive except for the one which is equivocal regarding Josephine.
So I have the book, Joseph Smith's Polygamy, Toward a Better Understanding. What's the thrust? What's the hope?
The hope is that people will go beyond the sound bites they read on the internet, right, and delve a little bit deeper into the topic. They'll realize how nebulous it is. Perhaps they'll understand the theology behind why Joseph would even do this a little better. That's probably our number one goal, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, the nice thing about this book as compared to my trilogy is that it gives you a really bird's eye view of everything that happened. Mm-hmm. But then the second half of the book are biographies of the 35 women. Laura allowed me to include the ones that we don't necessarily agree on, just for completeness, but nothing is left out.
I wish you could see the grin on Laura's face right now.
The biographies are important because it's interesting that even though there's a lot of questions, none of the 35 women who were sealed to Joseph Smith ever wrote an expose or were later critical of Joseph. Mm-hmm. Even the seven of the 35 who left the church did not come back and say Joseph abused them, that this was all about sex and abuse, or they were chattel. None of that occurred. These women respected Joseph, even those that left, and if they who knew what was going on were willing to go forward and not be critical, I think those that want to be critical should take pause at that.
I think, too, when people want to discount the reasons Joseph gave for the restoration of polygamy, they forget that they need to discount all the spiritual confirmations of the other people involved as well, mm-hmm, which to me is more difficult to do. It's easy to discount one person having not pure motives.
Sure.
But these were honorable people who went through a lot to live their religion. It wasn't an easy religion to live in 1840s.
It's not an easy religion now.
It's not an easy religion now, and it wasn't an easy religion then. I'll have to say one of my goals is voiced in the prologue. I think it's okay to validate people feeling uncomfortable with the topic, not liking the topic. I'll have to tell you, I gave my mother a copy of the book, and every time I see her, I say, have you finished it yet? And she'll go, well, not yet. I'm taking it a little bit at a time, because this is information that comes at you really fast, like a bullet train. A lot of it counters assumptions you've had from youth, mm-hmm, and it's okay to feel uncomfortable and not like it. For instance, I was visiting with my mother last week, and she said, you know, those 4 reasons you gave for the restoration of polygamy? And I said, yes. And she said, well, they're not good enough. You know, and I said, well, that's all we have. And then she said, you know, where Joseph tested Heber C. Kimball in an Abrahamic test, I didn't really like that. And I just told her, you know, it's okay not to like that. I think people need validation that it's okay to feel uncomfortable about some of the things Joseph did in his life. Mm-hmm. And for it still not to mean that they can't have faith in the gospel or that they're on the right track.
You yourselves, active members of the church?
Yes.
So, I mean, you're able to navigate that. I point that out only because sometimes people, I mean, like you say, they get uncomfortable. And then it's like, well, wait, who are these people that are telling me this? Can I trust them? Where are they coming from? Are they out to get me? Are they trying to get me to question who I am? And I think that you guys would say that you not necessarily question who they are, but question these things. Know what it's about. Which leads me to one of the final questions that I have. The essays that have come out on LDS.org,
You know, recently we read the news story about the guy in Hawaii who, he has a Nigerian wife and he teaches about blacks in the priesthood because one of his kids in his class, you know, says, hey, how come they did this for such a long time? How come they banned blacks from the priesthood? And so he went to LDS.org, got the article about it and said, well, this is, you know, where we're coming from. This is where it is. And he was released from his calling because the bishop said, where did you get this article? Why would you share this? Why would you answer a child's question? How do you feel about the stuff that's written about polygamy at LDS.org?
Well, first, I'd like to speak to that news story because I'm in the Relief Society presidency, and when it's my turn to teach, every time it's about one of the gospel topics essays. Mm-hmm. And they're difficult lessons, I must admit. But the brethren have come out. It's on LDS.org, and they have told us we can teach these things. They've approved them. Mm-hmm. So I feel very comfortable teaching the essays. And I don't know the whole story because we never heard from the bishop in that story. So I hate to judge in that situation, but I would say, for me, I feel very comfortable in the decision to teach those gospel topics pages whenever and as often as I can. I teach them to my children in family home evening. Mm-hmm. I discuss them with my neighbors because information is crucial, I think, and information in a nurturing, trustful environment is even more important.
Absolutely. We both believe that the answer for our doubts is more knowledge, not less knowledge.
Right. So about the essay about polygamy on LDS.org, you guys thumbs up? You're like, well, they could have gone a little further. What's the feeling?
I thought it was excellent because it hit every controversial topic. As we've discussed, there are a number of them that keep popping up. It hit everyone. They did not dodge any of them. And in fact, some people have looked at this book that we've come out with as kind of an expansion of that. Mm-hmm. And then if somebody wants the full meal deal, then get the three volumes. I liked it because it was concise but it hit on all of these topics. And then if people want more information, there's options for us now.
The book, again, it's called Joseph Smith's Polygamy, Toward a Better Understanding. You can get it online, I know, at gregcoford.com.
Deseret Book has carried it certain of their stores. It's available online through Deseret Book as well.
Awesome. Amazon and everything like that as well.
Yes.
Is it available in an electronic form?
Yes.
Awesome. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
I like having the book itself because though I've just barely had the chance to start reading this, I'm one of those guys that is writing in the margins and, you know, folding over a page and everything like that. We ask everyone who steps into the Cultural Hall three questions, so I'll ask each of them of you guys right now. You already answered one of them, but I'll have you answer it again just for the sake of it. Do you have a calling in your ward, and if so, what is it?
I'm second counselor in the Relief Society presidency.
I'm a teacher's quorum advisor.
Nice. The second question is, if you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that exists or make up one, what would you pick?
Nursery, toys, tots, and treats. Love it.
You know, that's hard. I love to teach. I would just add, though, for 14 years, I sang in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Oh, really?
And that's just the celestial kingdom of callings, I think. So
that sounds awesome. I'll have to ask you some questions about that, because at one point, I'd love to do it.
Oh, sweet.
I sing. Yeah. I don't know that I sing well enough, but I just think that would be awesome as far as a calling goes. And then the last question that we ask everyone... so you didn't answer... You said you love teaching, but you didn't answer the question. What would you pick for yourself?
Well, it would be in the choir.
Oh, you'd go back to being
in the
choir? Yeah,
I'd go back to there.
And what's the rule? Sorry, side jaunt. There's a rule now. You can't be in the choir for very long.
20 years or 20? Age 60, whichever occurs.
Or when you're newlywed.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2 months after I remarried, I resigned. But I'd been in for a while, and it takes up a lot of time. But it's wonderful. Mac Wilberg and everyone there is just inspiring to me, just remarkable people.
If you, yeah, I think that's great. And back in the day, because my grandfather was part of the choir, it was a calling, I think, then until you resigned.
Yeah, there was no age limit.
There was no, like, 20 years or whatever. No. It was until you couldn't do it anymore. And he sacrificed so much because he just loved it so much and saw the blessings. It's kind of a side jaunt. I just remember he's got this really great suit. He's since passed on, but it's been kept in the family. One of the suits that, you know, you guys now, you just wear black, right?
They have several suits, but they buy them and they keep them there under the tabernacle in a dressing
room. And the women always have the dresses that we go, can't we get them something more flattering than these things?
Really? I'm not going there.
I know you're not going
there. I'm not going there.
And I understand why they do it the way that they do it. But we do go, come on, something. They don't look like women in those things. Mm. That's me. That's my words. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
They're wonderful ladies, and their voices are amazing.
Yes. So. And their costumes aren't important.
There you go.
But he has this old, like, tuxedo jacket from when he was in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir that has, like, it's blue satin and, like, a flower-embedded velveteen print. From when he was in the choir. It's just
they had phased those out by the time I got in 99. So
you missed out. You should have gotten a little earlier.
I did miss out on that.
The last question that we ask everyone that steps in here is, what is your favorite part of your faith?
Well, my favorite part is that it's my own. Of course, when we're born in the church and raised in the church, we kind of exist on borrowed light. But there came a point in my life where I needed to get my own testimony because of personal tragedies. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I did that the hard way through prayer and study. And so I cherish my testimony a lot because it's mine and nobody else's.
Cool. I love that.
I enjoy the Spirit. As I'm singing in the loft with the choir, I mean, the Spirit would move me sometimes that I couldn't sing. And then I've had other callings and bishoprics where we struggle to know who's to get what calling. And there's a process there that's very spiritual to me where the answers truly do come. And Joseph Smith said, you know, if ye receive not the Spirit, ye shall not teach. And that's something that in the blogosphere and podcastville, I mean, we don't hear a lot of people worrying about teaching by the Spirit. And it's something very real for me and something that I cling to, like Laura said, that very personal, but also the one thing that I hold to and I'm so grateful for.
So you guys have this book that's out just barely. What's next? What's the next thing?
Well, I have another book coming out in January.
Okay, tell me.
It's an anthology. Okay. I'm actually really excited about this. It's a book I've edited. It's about 17 topics now, like polygamy, that make members of the church a little bit concerned.
Oh, nice.
And so I have recruited 16 scholars to write on these topics, people like Richard Bushman, Stephen Harper, Kent Jackson, D.H. Bailey, who's a respected scholar on science and religion.
So no big hitters, huh? Just some guys.
Yeah. No, they're all big hitters.
I'm just kidding, yeah.
So I'm actually thrilled about that coming out. I'm hoping that every family will buy a copy, read it, and talk about it in family home evenings so that there will be no surprises on the internet, because we'll have covered at least 17 of them.
Because you can't hide anymore.
Yeah, and if we don't talk about it, certainly hostile sources will.
What's the book going to be called?
We're still negotiating the title. That's what you do with the publisher.
Yeah.
So I'm not so thrilled with their title. They're not so thrilled with mine. They'll probably win since they have the ink and paper.
Yeah.
But it will be in your Deseret Book flyer if you get those.
Perfect. And we can maybe chat with you when that's coming out.
That would be great.
You can help us get Richard Bushman.
Okay, I can do that.
Nice. Perfect. And then what about for you, Brian?
Right now I'm just working on some websites coming out. I have one called MormonFundamentalism.com that I'm going to revamp. And working on some other projects. They're mostly apologetics and things like that.
Okay. Well, this is the time where we wrap it up. And so I'm going to invite you guys, if you have any of these things, to go ahead and add it in. But you know how we typically, within within the church, we have things that we hear in everyone's testimony or in everyone's prayer, and that's how we kind of end the episode. So we hope that this show has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you weren't healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that when the time comes, you'll be able to travel home in safety. Is there other things that you guys hear all the time that you're just like, come on, rote prayers?
And God wouldn't give you any challenges he didn't think you could handle.
Nice. Is there one that you have, Brian? I'm sorry to put you on the spot like this.
I'm just grateful to be in Joseph Smith's dispensation because I think he's given us some amazing teachings and revelations.
In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat, it's sure to be neat. On the back row, we really gotta go on the Cultural Hall show.
Ow!